Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's arguments before the Supreme Court on the Defence of Marriage Act, DOMA, and speak with Tobias Wolff, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School who has participated in some of the highest profile gay rights cases of the last several years. We will discuss the apparent split between the justices on overturning DOMA because it violates equal protection under the 14th Amendment and assess whether they will kick the can down the road rather than make a bold ruling. Then we'll examine the very real possibility of war or some kind of military action breaking out on the Korean Peninsula following North Korea's escalating threats and the cutoff of the hotline with South Korea. Sumi Terry, the former director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council, joins us to discuss the extent to which the North has dug itself into a rhetorical trap where they have to deliver on their threats and the possibility that this time the South will not roll with the punches. Then finally, we'll speak with Michael Lind, the author of Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States, about the real nature of American capitalism that is no longer about creating wealth, but extracting it in a new form of rentier capitalism that rewards the real takers, as opposed to industrial capitalism of old that was about makers. Michael Lind offers his arguments in a series of articles at Salon.com. Private Interest Parasites, How Rich Mooches Hurt America, and Defeating Useless Rich People. Joining us now is Tobias Wolff, who's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. His research includes the fields of civil procedure and constitutional law, and his advocacy work has included participation in some of the highest profile gay rights cases of the last several years. He's one of the nation's leading authorities on the U.S. military's former Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and has written on discrimination by the Boy Scouts of America, and has commented widely on marriage equality. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tobias Wolff.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me back on the program.
And today, of course, the second day before the Supreme Court today was the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA. Yesterday was Prop 8. Before we begin on DOMA, do you have any comments on what happened yesterday with Prop 8?
Well, I guess on both days, I would say that the court was clearly struggling a lot with the issues before it. There are some arguments before the court where, you know, while the justices are clearly exploring the issues, one gets a pretty powerful sense for where the consensus is on the court. And I would say it's difficult to discern consensus from either of these 2 days. In the Prop 8 argument, there are major questions about whether the case is properly in front of the court at all. There is this so-called standing issue, which sounds like a very technical issue, but is very important, which might result in the court deciding that it needs to dismiss the appeal. And an issue actually came up during argument over Prop 8 about whether the Supreme Court should have granted a writ of certiorari and taken the case from the Ninth Circuit at all. So in addition to the merits of the case, which of course is what most people think about when they talk about this lawsuit, there seems to be some questions that the court is struggling with about whether there's an appeal that they can hear at all.
So in terms of today's hearings, Tobias Wolff, DOMA, of course, the Defense of Marriage Act, was signed into law by President Bill Clinton in 1996, and it's been ruled unconstitutional by several lower courts that found it violates the Equal Protection Clause under the 14th Amendment. So it seems like the liberal judges on the court, not that they are liberal in the sense that the court has moved so far to the right that there are no Thurgood Marshalls and William O. Douglases anymore, but for the sake of our discussion, let's call them liberal judges, as the press does. They seem to be in favor of the 14th Amendment arguments that they should overturn it based on violating equal protection. But then the 10th Amendment was brought up, I think, by Justice Kennedy. So what's that argument, the 10th Amendment argument?
The DOMA case presents, as you say, a straightforward equal protection question, which is whether if Congress, as it has done in DOMA, singles out gay married couples and says, we'll exclude you from any federal favorable treatment for your marriage, even if a straight couple in the same circumstance would get all kinds of favorable treatment. That's the equal protection argument. The federalism argument, some might call it the 10th Amendment argument, has to do with the limited role of the federal government. You know, the federal government in the United States is very big, and it does a lot of very important things in our lives, and we're used to thinking of it as playing a very pervasive role, which in many ways it does. But it has always been a feature of our federal-state system of government that the federal government is authorized to set policy on certain matters, and they reach very broadly, but they're not unlimited. And one of the issues that I think there's pretty broad consensus is pretty much exclusively for the states to decide is the question of who's allowed to get married. Now, the states have to abide by other provisions of the Constitution, like equal protection, of course. But when it comes to just setting policy in the first place about who's allowed to get married, that's generally speaking the responsibility of the states. So one of the arguments that gets raised in the DOMA case is about the role of the federal government. Now, DOMA does not set policy about who's allowed to get married. But what DOMA does is to impose such dramatic burdens on married same-sex couples that some of the parties in this case have been arguing that it's interfering with the prerogatives of the states when it comes to setting their own marriage policies. And a related argument, once again, this is going to sound kind of technical, but it actually appeared to be very important in the arguments today. Whenever a government, whether it's the state government or the federal government, passes a law, they have to have some explanation for what their interest is in passing the law, right? What is the legitimate reason that the government has for enacting this law? And normally that's very easy. There's all kinds of purposes that government is allowed to promote with legislation. But one of the questions that was discussed a lot during argument today was what exactly is the federal government's interest in singling out one category of married couples and setting what's in essence a federal policy that says that you all are going to be treated in a disfavored way even if you're allowed to get married under state law. And that question of the kind of combination, if you will, of the federalism component of the case and the equal protection component of the case, it's something that the Solicitor General, Don Verrilli, spent some time talking about during his argument. And that whole cluster of issues seems to be very interesting to the members of the court.
And again, I'm speaking with Tobias Wolff, who's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. His research includes the fields of civil procedure and constitutional law, and his advocacy work has included participation in some of the highest profile gay rights cases of the last several years. He's one of the nation's leading authorities on the U.S. military's former Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and has written on discrimination by the Boy Scouts of America and has commented widely on marriage equality. Now, the case, of course, was brought by Edith Windsor, an 83-year-old woman who got a hefty estate tax bill, which is much larger than that a heterosexual married couple would have to pay. And, of course, she was married just before her partner died. They got married in the state of New York, where same-sex marriage were allowed. But because taxes are federal, she got nailed. And that's she's seeking justice from the courts. My sense is, Tobias, there's actually a piece in Wednesday's New York Times by Maureen Dowd where she makes the argument that in both Prop 8 and DOMA, she expects this court to kind of kick the can down the road, to basically take the narrowest rulings and not to rule boldly. And she points out rather cynically that, of course, this is a court that's perfectly capable of being bold when it comes to Bush v. Gore or Citizens United, where they opened the floodgates for unlimited and unattributed money in our political system. So do you share that cynicism that this is going to basically, the can's going to be kicked down the road?
Well, I don't share a cynical view of these cases. I think that in the Prop 8 case, there are some legitimate and genuinely serious questions about whether this case is properly before the Supreme Court. And in order to issue a ruling on the merits of this case in Prop 8, the court would actually need to make some law about how lawsuits get appealed and how lawsuits get brought in front of the Supreme Court. And I won't go into detail about that, but suffice it to say that as a procedure scholar, I care a lot about those issues. And I don't think it's cynical at all to say that the court needs to give them some very serious attention. In the case of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, There was argument today on another technical issue, which the court asked the parties to address, about whether the fact that the Obama administration has ceased defending the constitutionality of DOMA means that there's some kind of problem with the case coming up to the Supreme Court. I would be very, very surprised if that kind of technical issue wound up carrying the day in the federal DOMA case. I think that the court is going to issue a ruling on the merits in this case. And so I guess then the question is, what are they going to say? Now, it's very dangerous to predict outcomes in Supreme Court cases, but if the court were to rule in Edie Windsor's favor and either say that DOMA was unconstitutional as applied to her, or to say more broadly that DOMA is unconstitutional when it's applied to legally married gay couples, that would be a big ruling. And, it remains to be seen whether that happens and how broadly the court writes in its ruling. But I think that, with all respect to Maureen Dowd, I don't share her cynicism. What I expect is a serious grappling with these technical issues in the Prop 8 case, and I expect a decision on the merits in the DOMA case, whichever way it goes.
So a serious grappling with the technical issues in the Prop 8 case would basically take us back to Judge Vaughn Walker's ruling.
Well, that's a possibility. I wish I could make this sound simple, but it's tough to do. One bottom line possibility is a ruling that would basically make Judge Walker's district court ruling the last word. And if that happens, then there's going to be a little bit more work to do in figuring out exactly what that means for gay and lesbian couples in California, other than the ones who were actually the parties in the lawsuit. Another possibility, if the court decides to simply dismiss the appeal to the Supreme Court, if it sort of changes its mind, as it were, and decides to just get rid of the appeal, which is one of the possibilities that Justice Kennedy raised during argument yesterday, if that were to happen, then barring any surprises, probably the Ninth Circuit's ruling would be the last word. And if the Ninth Circuit's ruling wound up being the last word, then that would mean that Prop 8 is unconstitutional for everybody in California, at least for now. There would be a little bit more work to do in down the road in making sure that stuck. But there's the possibility of further chapters in the story in California. People have been grappling with this issue for such a long time in California that I know they just want a clean resolution. But one way to get a clean resolution in California would be for Prop 8 to be repealed. And that's still a possibility. But short of that, there may be more work to do.
Well, the polls would indicate that that's a possibility since they've shifted so dramatically since 2008.
Yeah, I think that's right. I saw Attorney General Kamala Harris on a news program the other day, and she cited a figure which I had not seen, but I'm sure it's correct, that 61% of the population in California would like to see Prop 8 go. And that is a dramatic shift, and if it's pretty close to accurate, then that might be a good avenue.
So, Tobias Wolff, since you have done work on cases involving discrimination by the Boy Scouts of America, as well as a number of gay rights cases, one of the things I find extraordinary here is that the Mormon Church was largely behind Proposition 8. The Mormon Church is largely behind the anti-gay discrimination in the Boy Scouts because they're a dominant member of the Boy Scouts of America. And even though some of the very high-profile corporate heads are on the board are urging that the Boy Scouts of America catch up to the 21st century or even the 20th century, the resistance is coming from the Mormon Church. And, of course, the Mormon Church overturned or prevented the ERA, Equal Rights Amendment, from becoming law. So do you see, I know Mitt Romney didn't get elected, but what is going on here in terms of this small but powerful lobby?
Well, I'll just mention the work that I've done in relation to the Boy Scouts. I've not been involved in any of the litigation. I've written about the Supreme Court decision in that famous case, the James Dale versus Boy Scouts case. And I'm not sure that it's fair to single out the Mormon Church quite so dramatically. There's been a lot written, and appropriately so, about the role of the Mormon Church in California's fight over Prop 8. But, I mean, maybe there's information I'm not aware of, but I wouldn't have identified the Mormon Church as such a central figure in some of the other fights that you identified. But, you know, more broadly, I think that there is a national conversation underway, and it's a conversation that includes strands of law and constitutional principle. It includes political development. You see major shifts in the endorsement by Democratic politicians in the last couple of weeks, even for marriage equality and repeal of DOMA in the ramp up to the cases in the Supreme Court today. And there are major discussions going on in churches of all denominations. And that is a necessary process. You know, this kind of civil rights issue is never a simple matter of, you know, one bold pronouncement and then we can put it all behind us. There's plenty of people in the public square who I disagree with. There's plenty of people in the public square that I agree with. But, this is the conversation that we need to be having in order for this shift in the citizenship status of gay and lesbian people to be a really lasting one.
But in terms of religious conservatives and their influence over this issue of gay marriage or marriage equality, what was striking in today's hearings before the Supreme Court, Tobias Wolff, was when Justice Elena Kagan told the courtroom and quoted actually from the official House of Representatives transcript of 17 years ago when legislators said that one of the main reasons to pass DOMA was to express moral disapproval over gays and lesbians being allowed to wed. And that provoked, gasps from the audience.
It was a very dramatic moment. I was not in the courtroom, but I listened to the recording, and you indeed can hear the gasps when Justice Kagan read that language. It is important to point out that moral disapproval of the type that was expressed in that House report is not the exclusive province of religious conservatives or any other group. These are struggles that we have to have across the board to engage with people and to really, show people who aren't yet convinced that gay and lesbian brothers and sisters have the same qualities of humanity as any other member of the American community. And, I think that there are major shifts underway in religious communities, including conservative religious communities, around this issue. There are major conversations going on in denominations around the country about what their views ought to be on this issue, but also how much of a priority it ought to be in their public advocacy. And the fact that Justice Kagan's recitation of that House report provoked gasps is, I think, some indication of a change in sensibility.
Well, just in closing, Tobias Wolff, just back to the to reading the tea leaves here, or handicapping what's going to become the ruling that will come down in June. What's your sense, though? Back to that question about whether it'll be narrow and undramatic, or whether it could be what so many people that are demonstrating in front of the Supreme Court are hoping for, which is that same-sex marriage in this country will become legal. So obviously, between those two possibilities, the ruling is likely to come down. But given that, as you've just pointed out, the times have changed, etc., just based upon the demonstrations taking place in front of the Supreme Court with the pro and con, there is the possibility, of course, of a social backlash, which, in fact, Judge Vaughn Walker warned Theodore Olson about in the original ruling. So how do you think it's going to come down?
Well, I will say this. With the caveat that predicting these things is a perilous endeavor, there were very few indications in the argument for the Prop 8 case that the court was interested in issuing a sweeping, broad ruling. That certainly doesn't make it impossible, but listening to the justices and the questions they were asking and what it sounded like they were genuinely grappling with, there were very few, if any, indications that this was a court that was eager or perhaps even ready to issue a really sweeping ruling. In the DOMA case that was argued today, there was certainly a lot of skepticism on the court, partly about the equal protection concerns, partly about the federalism questions. It was interesting that really no one arguing before the court today, particularly Paul Clement, the former Solicitor General, who was arguing in defense of DOMA, no one was really making arguments about why straight couples' marriages are better than gay couples' marriages. The arguments in favor of DOMA were really sort of very sanitized, I guess, arguments about we want to take things slowly and we want to have a uniform policy before the federal government, arguments like that. And that says something when the arguments in favor of the statute seem a little bit soft in their language, if you know what I mean. So maybe that gives some indication of the direction the court is leaning in the DOMA case. But in the Prop 8 case, I would be very surprised if they issue a broad ruling.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Tobias Wolff.
Thank you for having me on, Ian. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Tobias Wolff, who's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. His research includes the fields of civil procedure and constitutional law, and his advocacy work has included participation in some of the highest-profile gay rights cases of the last several years. He is one of the nation's leading authorities on the U.S. military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and has written on discrimination by the Boy Scouts of America and has commented widely on marriage equality. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the very real possibility that there'll be a war or some kind of military action between North and South Korea.
No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in